And now, live from Jerusalem, you're listening to Israel Inspired Radio. Here are your hosts, Rabbis Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel.
Shalom and welcome to Israel Inspired on the Land of Israel Network, thelandofisrael.com. Ari Abramowitz here with Jeremy Gimpel, who has really proven to be quite a hero lately.
Wow. A hero. I don't feel like a hero.
No, what do you feel like?
I feel pretty dizzy. Each day is another adventure. You know, it 7-8 months ago, I was like, wow, I'm just a brave guy. I'm moving out to the mountain. I'm taking my 6 kids, pioneering the land of Israel, the deepest settlement in Judea. But now it's like crunch time, and the bravery has flown away, and I'm just left with the real me, which is kind of finding it hard to take deep breaths. That's where I'm at right now.
Yeah, it's like you've transitioned from the famous story that I've told on the show before, from being my great uncle to the machine gunner on his plane. He used to go up there ready to fight, wanting to kill Nazis, and every single time his machine gunner partner went up with him, he soiled himself when he was in the plane.
So I'm the soiled guy.
Just momentarily. Momentarily. But the point is, you're still going on the plane. You're still take one foot in front of the other. Well, and let me just tell you, when I first moved out here, I thought it was just going to be immediate bliss. And it was not. It was very painful, very difficult. There were times I was depressed and it didn't make sense to me. And I was depressed about the fact that I was depressed. Like, what in the world? I'm in the heart of paradise. But I realized in retrospect that I was jumping up a huge level in my life, in my essence, in spiritual world. And so I face planted. So when you're face planting, you're so disoriented. There's such a swirl of chaos around you that you don't know what's going on. But once the dust settles, you look back and you say, wow, I just jumped a huge level. And from my perspective, that's what you're going through. And I think you are absolutely holding it like a champ.
Well, that's really nice to hear. You know, I had a pretty profound experience last week where I went to the funeral of Rabbi Emanuel Quint. Rena Quint was her husband and probably my mother's best friend. She survived Bergen-Belsen. Her story is unbelievable. We actually interviewed her on Yom HaShoah.
She wrote a book called A Daughter to Many Mothers.
Yeah, it's, you know, her mother was killed by the Nazis, and then a random woman adopted her, and then she was killed, and another random woman just took her under her wing, and somehow she survived the concentration camp and made it ultimately to the United States, really lost everything, and married this amazing man named Rabbi Emanuel Quint, who was a huge Torah scholar, just a huge tzaddik, just a sweet, wonderful, loving man. And it was his funeral last week. And so, of course, I went to the funeral, and there were a bunch of people there. And where I was positioned, where I was situated, I could really only see Rena Quint's face as they were, like, literally, like, putting him in the ground and burying him. And as I was there at the funeral, you know, there's some funerals that I've been to that have just been heart-wrenching. They've been so hard because life was taken away from someone that had so much life ahead of them. But as I was, like, you know, listening to the eulogies, how sad can you be? I mean, he lived an amazing life, wrote Torah books, raised children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren in the land of Israel. I know, it's just a life well-lived. Like, it's like not a happy funeral, but it's like you can't, it's hard to be that sad. And then as I'm looking at the actual Leviah, the actual burial, I can only see Rena's face. And she's, you know, watching her husband being put into the ground.
It's, and when I go to funerals, that is the most dramatic moment where really the point is made.
Yeah, it's like that he's not coming back. And the look of sadness on her face was so overwhelming. I'm just one of those things that I'm probably never, ever going to forget. And then what I thought was, like, the love that she had for her husband is a love that's just unparalleled to anything that I had ever seen. Meaning, I kind of take pride in my relationship with Tehillah, and I think that Baruch Hashem, we're just like a big love affair and we're best friends. But to live such a deep life together where you're raising great-grandchildren in Eretz Yisrael, it's like you can only really appreciate what love is with a covenant that was made. And I'm like looking, you know, I have a brother-in-law that's in California, in, you know, in Berkeley and in San Francisco. And just the whole modern world now, everything is so shallow and everything is so superficial. And I was watching this new age guru that says everyone should just get divorced. And why would you stay in a marriage if you're not even in love at that point? You should, if you love someone, you should be with that person. If you don't love them, don't be with that person and come here and go there. And, you know, it's just like so fleeting and so meaningless. And the love that I saw in Rena's face was so deep and so profound and so overwhelming. But I realized that a love like that can really only be achieved with like a real covenant, with a deep relationship that goes through ups, that goes through downs, that goes through times, that goes through challenges. And it's like what the basis of the Torah is. It's a book of covenants. It's a book of relationships that Hashem is with the Jewish people through the ups, through the downs, through the exiles, through the redemptions. And the relationship between Am Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is growing deeper and deeper all the time. More and more Torah books are constantly being produced, more and more writings. It's like the print press from Sinai just keeps on printing out more and more Torah. And I think it's like a contra to the modern world. The Torah is an alternative lifestyle, but the alternative lifestyle, it, to me, when I saw that funeral, was so obviously better than any modern, let's not have get married, let's not have children, let's not be, like, all, there's all these studies that are coming out about millennials, how none of them are getting married, none of them are even buying homes. They're all just like fleeting through life. How deep can your emotions be? How deep can your relationships be? What is it really to love? And if you've lived in this world without really loving a land, without loving a country, without loving another person, then like, what have you lived? You haven't really lived. And I feel like coming to this place, I've given all that I have to this place in Judea. It's all of my emotions have been poured out here. All of my money has been poured out here. My whole family is coming out here. But I feel like only in that act of just giving it my all can I really develop a love for this place.
You know, you're talking about Rena Quint and Emmanuel and the love that they have, and you said a covenant, right? And it made me think, I just found it right here as you were speaking, that the Midrash says, why does the Torah mention the merit of the land alongside the merit of the patriarchs, right? Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Reish Lakish says, this can be compared to a king who has three sons and a maidservant who raises them. Whenever the king inquires about his sons, he also inquires about the woman who raises them. Similarly, whenever the Holy One, blessed be he, mentions the patriarchs, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, he mentions the land with them. As it says, and I will remember my covenant with Yaakov, and also my covenant with Yitzchak, and also my covenant with Avraham I will remember, and I will remember the land. And I was thinking about that, just this land has witnessed so much, has not only witnessed, but has nurtured, has been a part of, has been a partner with so much, and the love affair between God and humanity, which really started with Abraham, right? Ahuvai, that God says, I loved, the first one, he says, I loved Abraham. So it was in this land that the love affair began between mankind and God. And now we are meriting to walk on this land and to be in this land. And it's part of a covenant. And I'll tell you, this week has been, I've spent a lot of time out there, and I've realized that the place doesn't mean as much as it could mean to me if I'm not loving the land itself, working the land. And that was a big part of the transition for me in moving out here, going from to being like an agricultural sheep. I'm not so connected with the sheep as I'd like to be, but the land is coming more and more and more and more. And I found my thing that I just love doing. Because we go to the vineyards and we work out there together, all four partners, and we're just working together. And there's a lot of work, very fine, delicate work with pruning in the vineyards. But I've been just pulling roots. I couldn't even walk for a day and a half after the first time I did it because it was these new muscles that I'm not really used to using. You're not used to like ripping things out of the ground for 3 hours, you know? I could barely walk. But there's something so cathartic about actually getting it and ripping it out from the root and knowing that now the land feels better, that it's able to focus on growing the fruit trees and the vineyards.
And not the weed.
And not the weed, which is just detracting the resources and the life force.
Also, I feel like the weeds here in the land are, they're like different kinds of weeds. Some of them are like sharp and pokey. And
oh, yeah, they're all sorts of different ones.
Like different. They're not just like regular weeds. So like when you get a weed out, it's like you've won a battle.
Yes, yes. Some of them, that's the case. And I don't feel like I've ever loved a land. I was even a little bit cynical about you know, a part of me was cynical of when people said back in the day, I love this land, love this. Like, I was like, how do you love? Like, I'm from Houston, Texas. I'm not in love with Houston, Texas. Like, what does that mean to love a land? You know, I was thinking when I was in second grade, right? This land is your land. This land is. Do you remember that? From California to the New York Islands, from the Redwood
Forest.
People
are going to tune out.
Yeah, it wasn't not the songbird of our generation. But, you know, we sing songs about loving America, but, like, what is that? I think it's the ideas. Is it really the land? I couldn't wrap my mind around it. But since being out here, I so deeply love this land, and it has given me such an overwhelming sense of vitality and meaning to my... Do you remember me before I was out here? I just look at what I was like a week before I moved out here, and I was just a different person. I'm like, life just didn't... You remember me. Would you attest to that?
Yeah, absolutely. Also, the land was a different land when we came out here. It was just rocks and thorns and dry and arid. And now there's like blooming, blossoming vineyards and fruit trees. And it's like we've seen the land come back to life, and somehow we've participated in allowing it to come back to life and nurtured it back to life. It's beautiful.
Isaiah says that the desert will blossom like a rose. And I always sort of saw that as some metaphysical miracle that will happen when we come out here. And there is definitely that. That is definitely a huge part of it. But we have connected drip irrigation. We are bringing water to all disparate parts of this mountain and the mountains that we're on here, which is one of our greatest expenses, is just the water. But so we're a part of it. It's happening through us. It's no less of a miracle, but I see the natural means by which Hashem has allowed us to bring this sort of revitalizing nature to the world, and especially now. Today is the Rosh Chodesh Av. Right, the new moon for the month of Av. So we're starting the 9 days, a period of more intensified mourning. We don't do our laundry. We don't listen to music. We don't eat meat. And really, what is the root of the sin of the 9 days of Tisha B'Av? It was speaking against the land of Israel, speaking against the land, and despising the land that our forefathers so cherished and loved. And so that's the way to fix it.
Yeah.
I think this 9 days, we have to be out there all the time. And not only that, we have to invite Jews from throughout Jerusalem, from throughout Israel, from around the world, non-Jews from around the world, everyone that wants to come and participate. We should really open our doors and welcome them and tell them, please come work the land, love the land. It will heal your soul as much as it will heal the land itself.
You know, I just, when I walk through these mountains, you can't help but just think about the memory that these rocks and these caves and these mountains have. You know, just Abraham was walking through these mountains, and King David hid in these caves, and Bar Kokhba was fighting in these mountains and hiding in these caves as well. And Ruth walked, you know, from Moab right past our farm on her way to the fields of Boaz in Bethlehem. And I was just reading recently, this was all over different times. Israel wrote about it, the Jay Post wrote about it, but Wharton Business School just ranked Israel as the eighth most powerful country in the world. And I was like, the eighth most powerful country in the world? Somehow that took me by surprise. I mean, Israel is such a small country, the eighth most powerful country in the world. And this was a serious study interviewing thousands of people. And they talked about the economy, the culture, military, diplomacy. And they said that Israel is the number eighth. And, you know, just to like list off the countries that are ahead of Israel: the United States, Russia, China, Germany, the United Kingdom, France, Japan, Israel. Israel is after those countries. It's like unbelievable to think that 70 years ago, the Jewish people were a broken, scattered bunch of Holocaust survivors and refugees from Arab countries. And we had no common language. We had no common culture. We had no economy. We had no natural resources. And today we're the eighth most powerful country in the world. That, if you think about the trajectory of what that means, what will be in 70 years from now? I mean, Israel will most likely be the most powerful country in the world.
Well, how do they gauge power?
So they talked about diplomacy, which was interesting.
Right.
They note that Netanyahu is the only person in the world that has warm, close relationships with Donald Trump and with Vladimir Putin. That's pretty unbelievable. No other country. It's either one or the other. And somehow Netanyahu has, over the years, developed a relationship with Putin and has had this relationship with Trump. So right now, in our diplomacy, in our world, the alliance.
He really
is
a master politician.
He's an unbelievable politician. I mean, think about where we are now militarily. You know, you and I have made videos about the 1948 war and the 1967 war and the amazing miracles that happened in those wars. But there was a time where, you know, we really didn't have an air force at all. We didn't have almost any guns, no uniform. Like there was no, we were just like a ragtag group of people fighting against armies far greater than us. Today, we're an atomic superpower and our enemies are using kites and balloons to try to hurt us. I mean, it's nuclear bombs against kites and balloons. I mean, the kites and balloons thing is causing terrible damage, and Israel could stop it if we just wanted to, if we just did. But if you take just a step back from a moment, although the disasters are happening and fields are being burned and people are being injured, they're using kites and balloons to hurt us where Israel is a nuclear power. So something is just going on that the memory of this land, as it's like saw the Jews rise and it saw temples burned and it saw the exile and it laid barren. And now the land is like reviving as we are being resurrected. It's like all of it is coming to pass now. All of us are being reborn and re-energized. And it's the symbiosis between us in this land, this country, in this time. It's just an exciting time to be alive.
It really is an exciting time to be alive. And I think when you look throughout Jewish history, where do those times that really make us powerful come from? When do they happen? And I think, you know, looking at this past week's, this week's Torah portion, we see something that was almost a serious existential crisis for the Jewish people. A moment that I really, my heart goes out to Moshe Rabbeinu, because I can almost empathize with the sensation he must have had in the soul, because I've been there where, you know, you make one horrific mistake or you witness a horrific mistake and then you see it happening again. And this is when they're about to go in the land. And Reuven, the tribes of Reuven and Gad, and what ended up joining them, half the tribe of Manasseh, or even a little bit less than half the tribe, they come up to Moshe and they say, "Let us stay here, east of the Jordan. This is the best place for our flocks and our family." Notice they said flocks first, again, exposing a little bit over emphasis on materialism. And Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses is devastated. You know, I just put your feet in his shoes. 40 years of penalty. A generation has to die because of the spies coming back and speaking evil about the land and dividing the nation. And now they're coming and saying, "We want to stay on this side." Another division within the people. Not only a rejection of the land and a demoralization of the people, but a division within the people. And you see it actually almost manifests itself into an all-out civil war. Thank God it was averted. But in the 23rd chapter of Yehoshua, right, of Joshua, they almost go to civil war because those tribes set up an altar and it's almost mistaken as if it was idolatry, just to show the lack of communication and the misunderstandings that can happen just over the Jordan, let alone on the other side of the world. But this idea of unity, we've been focusing it on a lot of our shows with peace now. And what is really the root of peace now's hatred of the Jews of Judea and Samaria? It's that Jew within themselves. We spoke about that, and that unity really, Kol Yisrael Aravim Zeh LaZeh, all of the Jewish people are mixed in together. Our fates are dependent one upon the other. And we had coming out here last week a really special soul, Ilan Pomerantz. Right, he lives up in Rishpon, and he came out here to the farm, and we were walking around for hours with him, and he shared an idea that was really a mind-shifting one for me, that it really, that's what the temple, why the temple was destroyed. Right, I always thought the first temple was destroyed because of idolatry. That's the stated reason, that's what we understand, that was the primary sin. But he said, what led to that idolatry? What was the underlying root of that? Well, after King David, then there was King Solomon. And King Solomon had a son, Rehoboam. And because of a series of mistakes, it doesn't matter what, the kingdom split into two. And Judea was in Judah, and Samaria, and in the north is where the Israelites. And that split, that rift, caused Jeroboam, the king, to set up altars of idolatry in order to maintain his political power and prevent the Jews of northern Israel come back to Judah and Jerusalem during the three Shalosh Regalim, the three pilgrimages, in which their heart would return to God and to Jerusalem. And so that planted the seeds for idolatry, which sprouted in the temple and which caused the destruction of the temple and the exile around the world. So disunity was the initial seed for everything. And so I've been reading this book, Eim Habanim Smecha, which I think is, for me at least, the book of our times. It's such an important thing for me to read. And he brings out an idea that illuminated something that I always found very confusing. When Abraham had the Brit Ben Atarim, right, the covenant of the parts, it's one of those parts of the Torah which are so sort of abstract and confusing. And the Noam Elimelech shares this idea. He says, this is from the Torah, took all of these animals, cut them down the middle, and placed each half opposite the other. But the bird he did not cut up. So the Noam Elimelech says he placed them all opposite one another, but the bird, which represents Israel, he did not cut up. That is to say, nothing can measure up to the merit of the entirety of Israel. For even the wicked ones are filled with mitzvot, like a pomegranate is filled with seeds. And the Noam Elimelech refers to something he wrote elsewhere. He says, the entirety of Israel is righteous, without a single blemish. As it says, your people are all righteous. That's in Yeshayahu, chapter 60. Your people are all righteous. He wasn't just saying that. Yeshayahu, if you read the entirety of the book, he was a very powerful harif. What's the word for harif? Like strong.
Poignant?
Yeah, poignant. I don't know.
Spicy.
That's poignant. That's harif for food. Painful sometimes. Very brutally honest. And he said, your people are all righteous. Meaning that on some level that our eyes and our intellects cannot understand, we have to always remember that the deep underlying motivations behind every Jew, and I think really on some level, some capacity, every human being in the world is a good one. Therefore, even though individuals sin, the whole of Israel will retain its sanctity, and there is no adversary nor evil affliction in them, God forbid. Their form is forever engraved before God above, and the evil forces have no power over them, and the individual man connects himself to this collectiveness. Meaning, if you look at any individual Jew, you can have that Bilam's eyes. You can see where he is lacking and what he is wrong and bad in. But if you understand that he has elements in him that you don't have in you that are beautiful and great, and if you sublimate yourself to the collective and understand you are part of something much bigger and greater, and you believe in the good nature and good intentions of every other Jew, no matter how difficult that may be to understand, then that is what that collective consciousness is, what really ultimately redeems all of us.
Yeah, I think a lot about that in the founding of the State of Israel. You know, there were these several undergrounds. There was the Haganah, which was more the left-wing diplomatic underground. There was the Etzel, which was, you know, really battling for the land of Israel. The Lehi, which was specifically targeting the British. And, of course, the Haganah would very often turn in Lehi members to the British. And they were fighting amongst each other. And it seems, though, like retrospectively now, when we look back, it's almost as though all three of them were needed in order to accomplish the goal. Even at from their perspective, each one of them was doing the exact wrong thing. They're trying to be diplomatic with the British while these people are trying to kill the British. But somehow all of three of them kind of pressuring and working in the ways that they did really paved the way for the modern state of Israel. And so even though through their perspective, those people were evil and those people were righteous, somehow collectively they got the job done.
Yeah, I find that sometimes I still have, I get caught up in that conflict and where I would have stood, and I vilify the other side. Whereas even the other sides didn't vilify each other, right? Menachem Begin spoke well of Ben Gurion in the end. They understood, even though he tried to kill him, right? I mean, it got to the degree of the Alta Lena, where the Haganah was shooting at Holocaust surviving Jews with their ship of arms at the Alta Lena ship. And that's the degree of disunity that happened. But Menachem Begin, in my mind, is always going to be one of the great heroes of Jewish history because of his response to that, right? What did Ben-Gurion say? Ben-Gurion said, praise is the Totach, right? The cannon that shot at the Alta Lena. And Begin said, we are not going to civil war. We are not going to have a war with our brothers. And I think history has testified to the beauty and the wisdom of that move.
I've also been thinking a lot about that generation, you know, the generation right after the Holocaust, during the Holocaust, the founders of the State of Israel, what they had to live through. And then it kind of like put things into perspective that sometimes I get nervous, sometimes I get scared. Where am I going to live? You know, in 9 days, I'm, you know, leaving my home yet, my staff house here on the farm is not yet ready. So I'm just going to be kind of camping out in different places. Maybe I'll stay at my in-laws for a while. Maybe we'll go on vacation up north for a while, just kind of living out of suitcases. And I take comfort in the fact that I know that this week's Parsha is all about the journeys of the Jewish people.
Oh, nice.
Right? So I'm like kind of living in that way of just journeying from spot to spot and place to place. And a friend of mine came up to me and said, you know, Jeremy, I want you to know, although I haven't talked to you a lot about your move and what's going on, I want you to know the impact that you're having on everyone around you. And I said, well, what's that? And he said, you're making every one of us ask, what are we not doing because we're scared to do it? Just you're living an example of overcoming your fears and overcoming your nervousness and the obstacles that might be in pursuit of a dream, in pursuit of an idea, in pursuit of, you know, what you love, in pursuit of what you believe in. And you're not letting your fears get in your way. And it's such a light bulb for all of us to say, like, what am I not doing? And I thought that was like so nice of him to come up and say that to me, because I'm not necessarily that close with this person. And he came up to me and said, you know, that the impact that he's having just watching me and my process is making him kind of do his own little soul searching in tshuva.
But it's, I think, important to say this to you right now also, because if you think about certain times in the army during the most difficult points in training where they have you running up a steep hill, and as you're just ready to die, the commander runs up next to you harder, faster, and he's pushing his weight on you. At that point, you're not thinking about anything but death, right? You just end the pain. There's one more step is impossible to me, you know? And I feel like right now you're at that like sprinting uphill thing where it's difficult for you to see around you. So, you know, if you want to send an email or two, a few people have sent me emails about you. I don't know why they're sending emails to me about you.
And I don't know why you're not forwarding them to me.
I don't want it to go to your head. Now, if you want to send Jeremy an email, you should go ahead and do that to strengthen him. Jeremy@thelandofisrael.com.
Well, here's what it is. You know, the whole history of the Jewish people from beginning until end. I mean, this really is the end of the Torah, if you think about it. This is the very end of Sefer Bamidbar. And the Torah ends here. And then, like, the next book, Devarim, is really Moshe's final speech. But the Torah as the Torah in its own unit, it ends here, and it ends with this journey. And when you think about the whole Torah and the whole story of the Jewish people, it's all of our history is a journey. I mean, Abraham begins the story with a journey of Lech Lecha, journeying to the land of Israel. While he's in the land of Israel, he's traveling throughout the land of Israel. Then we are in Egypt. We're through journeying through the desert. We're building a temple. Then we're journeying through the exile. We're journeying back to Israel. And, you know, I guess the final message the Torah is giving us is that know that, like, this life, there really is no destination. Every hero throughout the Torah never really makes it to their journey, never makes it to their destination. Abraham was given a great mission that his nation is going to be as large as as many as the stars. He's going to bless all families of the earth, will be blessed through them. But Abraham doesn't really accomplish his mission. And then Moshe's given a mission to take the Jews out of Egypt and bring them into the land of Israel. And then Moshe dies, just like we read now in the end of Bamidbar, and he doesn't accomplish his mission. And then Joshua is sent on a mission to bring in the land of Israel and conquer the land. And then you see the book of Judges, and Joshua doesn't accomplish his mission. And then David is given a mission, and then he buys all the materials, buys the Temple Mount, and is ready, but he doesn't build the temple. And it's like all of our greatest heroes, none of them actually accomplish their dreams. None of them actually accomplish the goal. And the Torah ends not in the destination, but in just recounting the journeys. And I feel like perhaps, like, I'm speaking to myself more than anyone else, but it's just all of us just to enjoy the journey and to remember the stops along the way and to know that Hashem is with us, not just at the end. You know, this Western world is so goal-oriented. It's like, you know, what is the bottom line? What did we accomplish? But the Torah kind of is ending on this note of just the journeys and the different stops, saying that I want you to know that this life is a gift, because life is a gift. And the journey really is the purpose, and to remember each part of the journey. And in some ways, Moshe Rabbeinu dies in pursuit of his dream, in pursuit of his mission. And it's almost like to die in pursuit of a dream is to live the dream. And I feel like that's really the final message the Torah is giving us before Sefer Dvarim. And so just bless myself and bless all of us that we should really know that, that as long as we're in pursuit of our dream and in pursuit of our mission, and we remember that that is the mission, That's the blessing of the Torah.
Yeah, I got to tell you, Jeremy, coming out here this week, there were just a few groups, a few people that came by, and it was so beautiful. One was this documentarian, you know, his name was Todd. I mean, he's doing a full-length feature, massive documentary about Israel and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict on whatever. But these things come in such rapid succession, it just sort of, I'm just rolling with it. Like, they just came and I was interviewed. And speaking to this guy, Todd, he's a surfer. He looks like he just jumped off of a surfboard in California. But he said since he's a little kid, 4 years old, he's had a love for Israel and the Jewish people. He can't understand it. And it just, it came out in everything that he was doing. But he said he also wants to find a place in his heart to love the Palestinians, the Arabs. And he's here on a fact-finding mission. He wants to understand things more. How to have room and love in his heart for both sides. It was really beautiful. And then Hayovel came. You know, our good friends, the Wallers, our listeners probably know about them. I shouldn't explain about them every time. But they brought a group out here and just... I have little flashes of moments that happen, particularly when they all start singing, that the magnitude and the end in and of itselfness of them being here is so beautiful. And what is it really about? It's that they are on a spiritual quest. And I feel like I'm on a spiritual quest. Yismach lev mevakshei Hashem, happy is the heart of those who are seeking God. And those who are seeking God, the paths, the journeys end up converging, even if it's from very different sources that were at one point in history hating of each other and caused affliction and destruction and persecution. And now they're converging here on this hilltop in Judea. And it's really about a love for Israel, a love for the God of Israel. And then when you have a love for the God of Israel, it creates a love for Israel, because whether we like it or not, whether we identify it or not, our existence and our name is tied in with the name of Hashem, with the name of God. The prophet says, Atem Edai, you are my witnesses, right? And in this week's Torah portion, and I sort of want to wind down with this, even though it's not the windest downy idea, but we're talking about the war with Midian, and God said to Moshe, exact the vengeance of the children of Israel. And in the next verse, Moshe says to the Jews to inflict the vengeance of Hashem against Midian. So on the one hand, Hashem says the children of Israel, and then Moshe says, the vengeance of Hashem against Midian. And Rashi says, he who stands against Israel is as one who stands against the Almighty, against Hashem. And this is the same thing that happened with David and Goliath. The Goliath came out and said, I taunt the armies of Israel this day. And what did King David respond? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God? That our names are tied in with each other. And that's why, you know, you coming out here and coming to this mountain, giving everything up, it's not for yourself, and it's not even for the land. The land itself is also a vehicle and a vessel. It's for Hashem. You can see from your house, you look to the left and you see the hills and the desert of Judea. You can see almost all of Judea. And to the right, you can see Jerusalem. And those are the two sides of what this is really about. And so I want to bless you that you're always able to keep that in mind. And that's why I was telling you when you came in here that you need to start to read this book, Em HaBanim Smecha, in the third chapter, when it talks about settling the land of Israel. And it will answer all of those questions, and I think it will really soothe your soul. Because as we approach the 9th of Av, and I'll just end with this, there were times that it was difficult for me to really connect with the pain of what the 9th of Av is about. It was a huge leap for me, and I would try this and I would try that to actually feel that pain, because I felt like there was just some sort of barrier in my heart. But now when I picture, God forbid, being exiled from this place that we're at now, the pain, the grief, the never-ending tears, how I would describe it to my children and my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, and it to such a strength, I just know myself, I would not be able to stop talking about it, that they would be telling their grandchildren about this place, these mountains that we're in right now. And that's what real love can do. So I bless you, I bless myself, I bless all of our listeners, that we should be able to kindle within ourselves a deep and abiding love for each other, for the land of Israel, and for the entire world. And so I want to end the show with a Better Know a Jew segment. Really fantastic, interesting, insightful interview from just another Jew in the land of Israel. But when you walk around this place and you just meet people, it's like just the most fascinating, interesting, dynamic people you'll ever meet in the world. So I want to share them with you. So this is Joseph Cox. I sat with him recently in Modi'in and we had this interview. Shalom, shalom.
Every time there was an offer for the Palestinians and they said no, they were rewarded. The negotiations weren't working.
Is conflict over when one side declares victory or the other side declares defeat? Hopefully you'll get the answers on today's Rejuvenation with me, Eve Harrow, on the Land of Israel Network, as I bring you the recordings from the Victory Caucus in the Knesset in Jerusalem from just a few days ago.
Rejuvenation with Eve Harrow at thelandofisrael.com.
Shalom. So I'm here with Joseph Cox, a supremely interesting guy. And this is another segment in Better Know a Jew. And I was trying to explain to my friend Joseph here what this Better Know a Jew segment is about. And it's really to convey, as you all know, that normally if I was living in America, Australia, anywhere else in the exile, and I want to meet a guy like Joseph Cox, I have to travel on across the country, have a layover in Boston Airport. But no. Here in Israel, he's just down the street in Modi'in, and I can already tell that this interview, if I really let it rip, we could go on 3-4 hours. So I've been trying to get him straight in my head the different elements that I want to focus on, because there's nothing I hate more than doing an interview and then finding out that I did not ask a question to elicit an extraordinarily important part of someone's essence and just leave the entire thing out. And he said, I guarantee you there's going to be questions that you're going to miss that will leave out entire things, because he said, quote unquote, my life story is very, very strange. So I want to focus, right? Was this
That's what I said, yeah.
That is what he said. And those are the most interesting people. I think on some level, mine could be as well, but I have a feeling I'm going to be put to shame on this one. It's just a gut that I have.
It's a playoff.
Right, so he's written a book called The City on the Heights. We're going to hear about that. I have heard extraordinary reviews about this book. He has something called Torah Shorts, where he writes these little short stories that encompass and convey certain beautiful parts of the Torah portion in an out-of-the-box sort of way. I'm going around in Modi'in. I didn't have a chance when I was here for Shabbat in Modi'in before Shabbat to really read all about you. I like going into an interview a little bit more educated, so I'm asking different people about Joseph Cox, and it's like I'm asking people about different people altogether, because people focus on different parts of your essence. So we're going to talk about the Torah, your perspective on that. We're going to talk about the book. But let's just start off with your birth. You were born where?
I was born in Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon.
And I was raised being told that I was born in an abortion clinic. My father's idea of a joke is that I would think perhaps that I wasn't entirely wanted. My mother's doctor believed very much in population control, and tried to dissuade my parents very much from having me. And he was an abortion doctor, but that's not where I was born. I was born in a Legacy Emanuel Hospital in Portland, Oregon.
So they just went to a normal doctor who's trying to convince them to have an abortion.
Yeah, he believed, this was the 1970s, and it was very popular then, as it is in certain communities now, to discourage people from having more children because the world had too many people. And so the guy was an evangelist for this and believed that that really my parents were having too many children.
Wow, that's a pretty sick pathology to be a doctor that's a mission is to convince people to murder their unborn children. Fascinating. So I hope you weren't privy to that conversation. It didn't offend you from within the womb.
Oh, no, not at all. But this is very much in flavor with a lot of the Portland culture. We had, before we moved here, we had 4 children, and 3 of them are triplets. And so one time we were walking in the streets, and this woman looked at us, and she's like, you have 4 children? Like, really, really disgusted by this idea. And my wife said, yeah, but these are triplets. And he goes, oh, you only meant to have 2. That's okay.
I was in Portland, Oregon when Trump's victory was announced. I was sitting at a vegan bar and looking around. I wasn't even looking at the television. I was looking at the people in this. It looked like they were watching 9/11. You know, like the Twin Towers falling down. It was horrific. People were crying, weeping, consoling each other. It was out of this world.
I'm sure it was worse than 9/11.
Yeah, for them, I'm sure they look back at that day more traumatized. Anyway, okay, so you were born in Portland, and you said something about Idaho. How did that happen?
Yeah, so before my family lived in Portland, they lived in the middle of nowhere in Idaho. They lived 10 hours from the nearest town for 8 years with no other people around. And so they ate bears that they shot, and my mother would can. They ate mountain lion one time. It's a fun story.
Okay, just open parentheses. What's the mountain lion story?
Open parentheses, mountain lion story. So so they had a guy who worked for them. His name was Mark Houston Haney. He had a certain religious perspective, which was that you could do basically anything, but you couldn't swear. He'd kill you for swearing. And for lying, too. That was a bad thing. He was actually was a ballad written about him where he came from in South Carolina, in Oconee County, South Carolina. And the ballad was about him in a divorce hearing with one of his wives. He had a number of wives. And the wife said something he believed wasn't true. So he said that's not true and started shouting. And the judge ordered the bailiff to restrain him. And he picked up the bailiff and threw him at the judge. And so it was the Ballad of Mark Houston Haney. So they were starving. It was springtime, and they were desperately hungry. And they were
your parents,
my parents, desperately hungry and at risk of dying of starvation. And so they sent Mark Houston Haney out with a shotgun to go find a bear. The bears are hibernating. You go into a cave, you stick the shotgun in the cave, you shoot the bear, you bring it home with help, and my mother would can it, and then they would survive the winter. So he was walking along, and he saw this kitty cat. It was a big kitty cat. And it wasn't walking very, very well. It was actually walking pretty poorly. And just out of instinct, he turned and he saw the mother flying through the air at him. It was a mountain lion. And he turned and he fired and killed the mother. If my father had been there, he wouldn't have survived because his reaction time wasn't as good as Mark's. And then he ran home and just talked about those eyes. He was just totally in shock and fear from what had happened, but they needed food. So they convinced him to lead them back to where the mountain lion was, and they canned it. And they ate all. My mom hates mountain lion. She says it tastes exactly like you think a person would taste. And
ugh.
They took the last mountain lion.
It seems like it would be very gamey, not a lot of fat on there.
A lot, yeah. See, the smell was really what got her. And anyway, so they took the last can of the mountain lion, and they sold it to a guy in China. They told him it was a male, and it was a great aphrodisiac, apparently. And they got a lot of money for that last mason jar of mountain lion.
She sold canned mountain lion as an aphrodisiac to a man in China.
That's right.
I don't think that sentence has ever been said in the history of the... Shlomo Melech said, Ein chadash, nothing new under the sun. That's a new sentence. I've definitely never heard that. So I'm hearing you're eating bears and mountain lions, but you are a religious Jew here in Israel. You said that you were raised Jew as well.
These are my older siblings. And my parents. I was born a year afterwards. Unfortunately, my eldest brother died in an accident in Idaho, and they left immediately. And so I was born the year after and named after him. So I wasn't raised eating bear and mountain lion, but it was definitely part of our family's life in many, many ways.
Part of the legacy.
And we had bear blankets and all those kinds of stuff. And we lived in the country, but it was, you know, within distance of buying kosher food.
Just one backtrack. How did they end up? You were in Portland, Oregon. Then they ended up in Idaho with no neighbors. Because you said this closest city was 10 miles away. But I imagine there was probably neighbors around them. It just wasn't a city. But you're saying they were literally a house alone.
The closest neighbor was my great uncle, whose name was Buckskin Bill, the last of the Mountain Men. And there have been books and movies and stuff done about him.
I've actually heard the name Buckskin Bill last of.
It's my great uncle. Down the river, 4.5 miles down the river, there was a dude ranch. That was the next closest.
That's thing. Why you were introducing me to your kids. You're like, this is Yitzhak, this is Avram, this is Buckskin. Now I get it.
Yes, actually, one of my kids is named after him. The middle name of Yitzhak is Bezalel, because Buckskin Bill was a craftsman. And so he's actually named after Buckskin.
Also, Buckskin and Bezalel have a sort of similar ring to it, but that may have been accidental.
And that's true.
Okay.
So
Buckskin Bill was the last of the mountain men, was the closest neighbor that you had. He was your father's uncle and your great uncle.
Yeah, and that's why they ended up in Idaho. Uh-huh. But actually, they started off back east.
But was it an ideological move to Idaho? Why did they decide to make
really
such an address?
I don't know why, but I think that they were trying to create their own world. I don't think that was the plan Hashem had for them. I think that they were supposed to leave and change the world that was outside. But they started off, actually, my father grew up in Kansas and in Oregon, and he was considered mentally retarded. He had an IQ of 68. And then eventually he got a PhD from Columbia University. This can happen to mathematicians. So
he was probably on the autistic spectrum.
He might be defined that way nowadays.
Nowadays.
He certainly had some odd behaviors. He was kicked out of Carnegie Mellon. It's a great story. But the Carnegie Mellon sent a black letter to every place they thought he'd apply. Basically, they asked him what he wanted. He got into some trouble there. And he looked down at his stomach. He's a big guy. And he goes, "I want to have a baby." And he meant it. And so they booted him. And they sent a letter to every school he thought he'd apply to. Columbia got the letter.
Why would they be so interested in blacklisting him from every other school because he wants to have a baby?
It was the thing that...
That's also done. A question I've never asked
it
before.
It was the thing that was done then. Uh-huh. Because there had been, I think it was Hewlett and Packard, one of them, had been kicked out of Wharton or one of the other prestigious business schools. And every chance he got, he made a point of bad-mouthing the school. And so because of that, it was a policy of the top tier schools in the day
to have
you kick somebody
backs.
Out, you destroyed them. Because that way you didn't have to worry about them coming back and saying bad things about you.
Wow.
So Columbia University got the letter. They showed it to my dad. The dean did in his apartment. And my dad said to the dean, "Listen, Dean, after reading this letter, how could you possibly accept me?" And the dean said, "Rodney, after reading this letter, how could we possibly refuse?" And so, Columbia University was where he got his PhD. And that's where he met my mother as well. And she's her father was a communist bootlegger and factory owner. And they moved to Idaho afterwards. And that's where they became from.
Because I live on a hilltop on the southeastern tip of Judea, as I told you, and people come out there and like, "You're engaged. What kind of girl is going to agree to live there?" And I said, "Well, the right one, you know." But how did she agree to make a move like that?
It was a rough move. It was a rough move for both of them. And I'm not sure really what motivated it. It probably helped that she married a non-Jew and he married a Jew, and both of their families disowned them. And so you really didn't have to worry about too much of a connection beforehand. And eventually things got restored, but it was probably a good idea to spend 8 years.
Okay, and you said they became more religiously affiliated and connected with Jewish life in this Idaho.
Yes. So my grandfather was an apikoros. He comes from a long line of rabbis.
Define for our listeners what an apikoros is.
It's actually a Greek word meaning, I believe, a lover of food. But apikoros, Epicurean, is the same word. And so an apikoros is somebody who's very learned and rejects everything.
And they say that nowadays probably very few people could actually qualify as an apikoros because we're not learned enough to be a well enough educated heretic. We're just like considered.
The classic story is my grandfather's story. He had an apikoros club in Cleveland, Ohio. And one day a student from the Telshi Yeshiva, a very Haredi yeshiva, came by to raise money for the yeshiva. And the people in the Epicurus Club were like, "You should go to the Reform. You should go to the Conservative. Why are you coming to us?" And the Bacher said, "Listen, I went to the Conservative and I went to the Reform. But the fact is without the Telshi Yeshiva, there could be another generation of Conservative. There could be another generation of Reform. But without the Telshi Yeshiva, there will never be another generation of Epicurusim." So that's the definition
nice.
Of Epicurus. They gave him money. Also the definition of apikoros.
Right.
So they came from a very, very anti-religious, my mother came from a very anti-religious family, but they had an anti-religious family with a lot of intellectual history and a lot of intellectual power behind them. And so when they moved to Idaho, that became the gateway for them to become religious.
You said they had a lot of intellectual history. That's your PhD you got, right?
And my bachelor's degree is in intellectual history. It's a history of ideas, which basically you look at political theory and literature and science, etc., all on the framework of history to see how people think about big problems differently in different cultures and different times.
Okay, so I could zoom in further about curiosities I have about Idaho, how they came back, but we need to move forward. So give me a relatively quick timeline rundown of up until now, and then we're going to zoom in on the book, on the Torah shorts. You raised in Idaho. How did you end up here?
So grew up in a hilltop in Oregon, and we were from when I was born, very much traditionally Jewish, but the way in which we did things was very, very independent, because my family became religious in a community vacuum, totally by themselves. And so the intellectual way in which we pursued and interacted with the Chumash, etc., was very independent.
You actually told an interesting story that I'm going to ask you to bring up here, something that I think about often, because when you read through Jewish law, a lot of it is intuitive and it makes a sense, a lot of it insightful, some of it's curious, and some of it's like, what? You can't leave water out overnight because the venom of a snake may go in it or something like that. But to this day, when I leave water out overnight, I pour it out, I don't drink it, because that's the Jewish law, whether or not I understand the intricacies of it. You shared a development your family had that you said was actually a pivotal point in their religious journey.
Yes. So they use the Shulchan Aruch as a guide.
Shulchan Aruch is the code of Jewish law.
Yes, as a guide to rustic living. So the laws that we pay less attention to now, like how far away your outhouse has to be from your house, and standards of cleanliness that were very, very relevant in the 16th and 17th century, but a little less so now because we do things differently. These are the laws they cared about because they lived a very, very rustic life. And so they would read the laws and then they would say, you know what, this one's important to us and that one isn't. And they would dismiss all the laws that were unimportant to them. And of course, they cared about exactly the opposite laws of what people focus on now. And so they read the law that you have to cover water overnight or it isn't kosher. And they said, this is not one of the important laws. And they got rid of it. And then that very night, they stayed overnight and, you know, slept, and they left the water uncovered. And the next morning, my mother poured from a beaten copper pitcher. She poured water into everybody's glasses. And then she looked in the pitcher afterwards and there was a dead rat in it. And so that was the point at which they started keeping laws that they didn't already understand.
That's beautiful. Okay, I love those stories that you can pinpoint. That's when this started. Yes. And that's okay, great. So you were sharing the journey. Go ahead.
So grew up there, and we were all kicked out of the house, essentially. I dropped out of high school and went back east for school.
Why were you kicked out of the house?
My parents wanted us to become independent.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Yeah. So we were encouraged to go far away for school. So I went first to Harvard for a summer, and then I went to Columbia for a year, and then I went to Penn. I'm one of the few graduates of the University of Pennsylvania who does not have any sort of high school degree. And then I...
you took some sort of entrance exam? How did you get into Harvard without a high school degree?
I used my transcripts from Harvard and Columbia to get into Penn.
How did you get into Harvard?
That was the summer school, so that was open admission.
Uh-huh.
And Columbia was a bit harder. Columbia, it was a general school, and they had a high school visiting program, which I don't think was necessarily real. And I talked to the dean of the general school there, and I sat down at his office, and he said, why are you leaving high school, beautiful Oregon, to come here? And I said, well, you know, this academic thing I can do here that I couldn't do there, whatever. And a phone call came up, and he left the room. And he came back, he asked me the same question, I gave him the same BS answer, and a phone call came up and he left the room. And then he came back a third time and he asked me the same question a third time. And I said, high school sucked. He goes, okay. And he signed my form and I was in. So that was the process of admission for Columbia. And then I used that transcript to show that I was still in school when I went to Penn.
They were probably like, wait, high school sucks. This is the son of the guy that wanted to have a kid, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then to Israel, how did you end up here?
So at that point I was by myself. I haven't met my wife yet. And I did intellectual history and lived in various places. I lived in Boston, lived in New York. I was actually homeless in New York for a summer and then went back to Oregon. And when I was in Oregon, I wanted to meet somebody. And so I went online and I figured I should hit for small markets because the chances are the big market that I've been picked over. It was my thought process. I thought Melbourne was a small market. It isn't. And I saw my wife's profile and I introduced myself and she said, take a look at my profile. And she said, can't you do better than that? And I was smitten. So we got married a little less than a year later. And together we decided, after we lived in Australia and lived in Oregon, that really the place that we belonged was Israel. And so we moved here about 4 years ago.
And how has that been? When I first met you, just, you know, looking around the house, having what I heard about you, I told you that, for me, you fit the profile of someone that would not necessarily be in Modi'in. Keep in mind, I have a very high opinion of the Modi'in, the people in Modi'in, stellar people. But you seem more like a Shiloh. You know, you have these Torah books around, and you explained why you wanted to move here to Modi'in.
So the thing that's attractive to me in Modi'in is that if you look at the voting patterns for Israel, there's two cities that are closest to matching the actual makeup of the Knesset. And Israel has a direct democracy, so this is a very representative thing. The most representative city is Ramla, because it has Arabs and it has Ethiopians. But the second most representative city is Modi'in. Modi'in is the closest city, aside from Ramla, to actually reflecting the whole of the Jewish people in Israel. And so we wanted to raise our children in a place where they would be exposed to and be able to interact with a lot of different ideas. And by virtue of that, their own ideas and their own thoughts about the world would be much more strongly developed. And so that's why we moved to a place that has a diversity of opinions like Modi'in.
That's interesting. I was sharing with you that I've heard this argument played out at many different Shabbat tables. I don't know what my opinion is yet. I don't
have
children yet. Please God,
I'll know
at some point. But I'm interested to hear your thoughts about that, because there are those people that say, how can you expect for a little kid to have diversity of opinions? They're thinking about their navels and ice cream. You know, it's better to have a very vacuum-like indoctrination, teach them, educate them, share them, and then once they're very solidly built into who they are, then they go to the army or they go to university, and they're able to be exposed to all sorts of different ideas. So that's one argument that makes sense to me. On the other hand, your argument makes sense, but how do you resolve that? And has this played out? Has your philosophy played out?
I don't know about my children yet. They're still too young. But I know about myself. And my parents made a very, very concrete effort to expose us to a lot of different people and a lot of different ideas. Around our Shabbos table, we lived in the mountains. And so the people who could come for Shabbat were not other religious Jews. They were everybody else. And we had a whole variety of people. We also had about 30 kids with various drug and alcohol problems who lived with us at various times when we were growing up. And we were exposed to a lot of different people and a lot of different ideas and a lot of different problems. And by virtue of being exposed to them, we ended up growing a lot. None of us, for example, ever did drugs. And one of the reason for that was is we saw people who are on the other end of that, who are going through it and trying to fix their lives, and it was not easy. And so by virtue of the fact that we were exposed to other things, many of which didn't work.
You got to know what you don't want.
Yeah. And you also got to know the strength of where you came from in a way that wouldn't have been as obvious to, you know, be vacuum sealed, as you said, and then suddenly have somebody cut open the bag and all this air rush in and you don't know how to deal with it.
Mm. Okay, so let's jump here to this book that I'm looking at right now, The City on the Heights. Now, you're not a media guy. You're not a huge prolific author. But when I'm looking at some of the acclamations that your book has received, I don't see them here. I don't remember where I saw them. Maybe it was online. No, these are the Amazon ones you're showing me right now. Yep. But I saw online, there was Rabbi Daniel Lappin, a famous author, dear friend of mine that I know, that said beautiful things, life-changing things. Tell me about it. What is The City on the Heights?
So I tell the perspective of what The City on the Heights is from a lot of different directions, depending on who the audience is. Fundamental to the way I share ideas, I've discovered over time, is that if you just share an idea and lay out a logical path, it's actually not very interesting, and it doesn't change anybody's mind, and it doesn't get them to think, and it doesn't have any reality for them. It's just an argument. But if you can create characters that come across to the reader as real people, as people who are not cutouts or two-dimensional, and then you put them into an environment and put them into a situation where they're interacting with a different reality, then what you can do is you can explore ideas in a much, much more concrete way than you ever could with a policy paper. And so the idea of The City in the Heights is that there is, if you look historically at major, major war zones or troubled areas, three of them come to mind. One of them is Maoist China, which is a vast bloodbath. The second one is the Soviet Union. And the third one is Reformation Europe, when the Protestants and the Catholics were at war with one another. And in each of those three cases, the light that led the way out and showed a future path and a way to a better future was a city. Not a huge landmass that was conquered and subjugated and taught a better way of life, but one city that operated differently. In the case of Maoist China, it was Hong Kong. In the case of the Soviet Union, it was West Berlin. And in the case of Protestant Europe, where there was a third of the population was killed in those wars, it was Amsterdam. Amsterdam was the city that showed a different way of doing things. And so the idea of The City in the Heights is to take what I see as core Torah concepts and use them to govern a city that is open to people who are in the Arab world. The Arab world is going through a cataclysm of war and of destruction and of intolerance. And by virtue of that, there's actually an opportunity to open up new new avenues and new possibilities that can reinvent the region. And I think fundamentally the role of the Jewish people is to influence and better the world. And by establishing a city on a small part of the Golan Heights and inviting people from these troubled regions in, we can actually govern a place that shows a new way forward. And so the book is a thriller. There are people who are not idiots and who have very good reasons not to want the city, who try to destroy it. And there's Americans who are quite naive as they set it up and not understanding how the locals work, and it almost falls apart in violence. And then there's a character, Mariam, whose father was a infrastructure engineer in Mosul, who doesn't really belong to any of the groups. She's been raised as a secular Muslim, as a Ba'athist. And she ends up being the one who carries the bulk of the story as a 16-year-old girl, and ends up being the one who transforms the society around her. And so the story is about how that happens and the kinds of things that are possible in recreating and finding hope in the chaos and the war that surrounds Israel.
So what I've heard about this these Torah shorts that you do, it sounds like this is a Torah long.
That's exactly
in
right.
In some ways, your Torah shorts, you take the Torah portion, and rather than just give a Dvar Torah as we have them, where you just share a Torah idea, you make it into a story to convey, which is a sort of a Torah concept to begin with. The entire book of Bereishit, the reason it's everybody's favorite is because it's stories, it's compelling stories. So this would be a Torah long. So what is the foundational idea you're really trying to convey in this book? Is this city you're talking about that's established, is this something you would actually advocate?
It is something that I actually advocate, but in addition, the way you set up the city is very different than the way you set up Hong Kong or West Berlin or Amsterdam, because the people you're dealing with are different. And you have a population that's fundamentally religious to begin with. And the way in which you integrate a religious society and actually bring them to a better outcome is different than the way you would do it, for example, in China, which after Mao was not a religious society. The Cultural Revolution was pretty successful at that. And so this is not a book about establishing a capitalist bulkhead. This is a book about looking at ways in which we can encourage creation, encourage productive action, and encourage ultimately a relationship with God through both of those. And this is something that I believe is totally in tune with Islam, because Islam, like Judaism, like Christianity, comes in many different flavors, and those flavors are able to change based on what's going on around you and based on what doesn't work. And so I think that the idea of the book is that we can actually create a society that perhaps could be a model even for Israel, by virtue of establishing something with this sort of setup in the Golan Heights.
Okay. Now let's talk real life. This is interesting me now. You have the green light from the government. They'll give you all the resources you need. You set up this city. Describe the city.
Okay, I have to think about this, because in the book he doesn't get a green light and all the resources he needs, because for very good reasons, people in the Israeli government are basically, we're a real country, we're not here to play these sorts of fantasy
right.
projects.
We're not in the book anymore. Now we're in my book,
okay,
my story.
Now you're in your story.
You have the green light, you want to set up this city. Because to me, the description you're giving is a microcosm of Israel in general. That is this city. How is this city you're talking about different than what we are dealing with in Israel today, or at least what I'm dealing with on my hilltop in Judea, surrounded by Arab and Bedouin villages? We're interacting with each other all the time. That's part of the irony that I see, that I hear all of this leftist drivel coming out of Tel Aviv about how the settlers are racist, when in reality, the last time they saw an Arab was on the news somewhere, and I'm dealing with them. I'm putting food on their tables. I'm inviting them to my weddings. We're actually interacting with them. In this sort of little petri dish of Judeans and Jews and Arabs, and there's Christians that are coming out, Christians around there. So how is this city different than what Israel is?
There's two ways. One of the ways in which it's different than what Israel is that I think Israel actually, I think the Jewish people could do a lot better job of expressing what I see as core Torah concepts. And I think that Israel actually doesn't do the best job that it could in that regard. In this way, Great Britain, for example, after World War II, was not nearly as effective a demonstration of the power of Western capitalism as Hong Kong was. And Hong Kong actually ended up being a model for Britain as well. And so I think that if you have a small offshoot like this, you can play games and gain understanding about what's possible with the pushing the boundaries of ideas without feeling like you're risking your entire existence for it. And so the ideas in the book, there are ideas about taxation, there are ideas about the way money works, there are ideas about welfare that are very, very different than what's done anywhere in the world. And they're all based on this idea of imitating and walking in the path of God. In Bereshit, God is a creator for 6 days, and when he creates something, it's called good. But not everything is called good. Only the things that are connected to creation are called good. So darkness isn't good, man isn't good because we weren't creators, and Shabbat isn't good. Those are the three things. And also heavens are not good.
I mean, they're not called good.
They're not called good. Right. Everything else is called good.
Right.
Not called evil, just not called good.
Some things are called very good.
Yes. And so the heavens are not called good because they're actually not fundamentally themselves creative. But animals that are reproducing are good because they have that creative element in them. Shabbat ends up being kadosh. It ends up being holy, even though it's not called good. And so you have this cycle of goodness and holiness. And I think that that's the cycle the Jewish people should be trying to engender in the world, in places where they're only productive and they don't have a connection to something greater, a connection to the timeless. Then we should be helping them reach a connection to the timeless. And in places where there's a great connection to the timeless, but they're living lives of complete destruction, we should be helping them realize a life of creation. And for ourselves as well, we should be trying to capture that cycle of creating things and then dedicating those things to fighting against the losses and destruction and evil and loss of potential in the world, but also using those resources to connect to each other, to our fellow man, and using those resources to connect to God. That's the fundamental idea of korbanot. You are not allowed to bring a wild animal for a korban. You have to bring one that is raised because you are
domesticated or domesticatable.
It has to be domesticatable at least, and you perhaps domesticated. But the reason you have to bring those animals is because you actually were involved in making something. That's what you have to bring to Hashem. And so when you create something, you also can't bring fruit except for on Shavuot when you're thanking God for his gifts. Other than that, you don't bring fruit. And so when you bring these offerings, what you're saying is I am investing in the relationship with God. But in order to do that, you have to make something to invest. And so that is, to me, throughout the Chumash, the core concept. We embrace creation. We run away. Impurity is the idea of being exposed to a loss of potential. Chukat, this parsha, talks about how we fight that. We run away from a loss of potential. We run away from any sort of waste, creative waste, biological waste, whatever it happens to be. And we are constantly embracing the creative, but we're also applying that creative to our relationship with God.
So when you were talking about core Torah concepts that you would want to share with the world, that you want to convey, that's like your mission, that's the primary one?
That's the primary one, but it has very contemporary impacts. For example, we tend to have welfare systems that discourage people from working instead of having welfare systems that actually encourage people. To give an example, minimum wage. Minimum wage prices out people who have less capability from the workforce. Nobody wants to pay a blind person $15 an hour. It's not going to happen. And so blind people live their lives, even though they don't want to, they live their lives dependent on government aid and never working, and they hate it. I've talked to a number of blind people who hate it. They want to work, but as soon as they collect a paycheck, they lose their benefits. What we should be doing instead is saying, you know what? The idea of a minimum survival is not an issue for private companies. We're going to take whatever you earn, and we're going to supplement it for your initial spending each month. And so if you
come again, say that last sentence again.
We're going to supplement your initial spending each month. And so the first $100 you spend in a month, the government will chip in another $500. Uh-huh. And then that inverts, and they do exactly the opposite as you begin to spend more. So people are able to earn very little money from their work, but at least they're engaging in that process of creation, and they're not being locked out of it, and they can get what they need to survive anyway.
So basically, you're taking your foundational philosophy of mankind needing to create in order to have a sense of meaning and purpose, and you're plugging that into a economic system and saying, how can we engender meaning and purpose for people?
That's right.
Uh-huh. Okay, so this, it's beautiful, it's philosophic, it's somewhat abstract. I'll just say from my perspective, being on this hilltop in Judea, so much of the world is attacking Israel, really the tip of the spear from my perspective, obviously from my perspective, is the land, is Judea and Samaria. They're attacking our connection to the land. How would you apply this philosophy, or even not apply this philosophy, but how do you feel about, on a more practical level, the war being waged against Israel today? You were talking about Islam. How do you see that, the Arab-Israeli conflict within that prism?
So there's a war being raised against Israel, and we have an obligation, obviously, to defend ourselves. But fundamentally, let me tell you a story. We had a Passover, before Passover, a Shabbat before Passover. We had a meal, and unexpectedly, the people we had for the meal were Jews for Jesus. And they're Christian people, which is no problem for me.
Were Christians or Jews for Jesus?
One of them was Jewish by birth and was a very, very avid Christian. And the other one was just Christian, but also evangelical. They call it everyday Christians.
Because Jews for Jesus is different than just a Christian or even a Jew that is what they call a Messianic.
Sorry, you're right.
Jews for Jesus
Messianic Jews.
Right.
That's the right terminology. I apologize. So yes, you have Messianic Jews. And I was curious, the woman who was Jewish, what drove her away from Judaism? And as the conversation went on, what I gleaned, she may have heard something different or said something different, but what I gleaned from it is that she was driven away most of all by the Pesach Seder, by the Passover Seder. She went to the
Interesting, because for a lot of people, that's what keeps them in.
Yes.
That's so a continuity there.
It was fascinating. So she went to the Passover Seder, and it was nobody really understood why they were doing anything. The entire point of the ritual for the people who were leading it, was Jewish continuity. And I spoke in shul the next morning. I didn't know what I was going to say when Shabbos started, but I spoke in shul the next morning, and Pesach was coming, Passover was coming, and I said to the kehillah, my core message was the Pesach Seder is not about Jewish continuity. It's not about Jewish survival. That's God's job. The Pesach Seder is about the Jewish mission. And so our purpose in having the land is not so we have a land. It's not so we're safe. It's so that we can do the mission we are assigned in the Torah. And if we do that mission, we'll keep the land. And that's my perspective.
That's such a beautiful and refreshing message, because in my personal life, when I look at the journey I've been on, and then I look back and I say, what was Hashem guiding me to see throughout the whole thing? I see very often it's to be able to constantly sort of in a wax on, wax off Karate Kid sort of way, to not get confused the vehicle and the mission. It's so easy to get confused and to get very attached to the vehicle that you're in and forget the mission. And I've seen that my relationship with Israel, the land, has been so passionate and so overwhelming that there are times in my life that it became the end in and of itself. And only over the past number of years, ironically, as my relationship has even deepened with the land itself, have I really understood, as beautiful as this connection is, the land isn't my God. Hashem is my God, and the land is one of the most beautiful vehicles to connect with God. So is that what you're saying, that it's about the land being a vehicle?
So in Parshat Korach, which we read just last week, Korach's people rebel, and a lot of the people rebel because they didn't get the land. They're very, very resentful for that. And so the question is asked, why was Korach swallowed by the land? And I think that's very much a direct lesson for those people. They have to understand that the land is the servant of God, not itself the master, and not itself the prize. And so that's exactly what you're saying. It reinforces that point, that in fact the land is just a tool. And it's a tool for the Jewish people to fulfill their ultimate mission.
Wow. Okay, and vis-a-vis the Arab conflict that we're having, the quote-unquote Palestinians, the greater Muslim world, the city on the heights, it's a lot of Islam in there. What's the message there?
There's a lot of Islam in there. Islam is in many ways a religion that's very, very close to Judaism. It's just the emphasis is a little bit different than our emphasis, and it ends up with a very different result.
The way I see it, just on what you're saying, is like, let's say you're a pilot, a fighter pilot, you shoot a missile, 100 kilometers away. If it's off by 0.001 degree, it's going to land 20 kilometers off. So Islam is very much like that. When you say it's a similar religion, I know a lot of our listeners will be like, there could be nothing more different. But it's really not true. There's little nuances here and there, like, modesty. We both believe in modesty, but when you take it and you just distort it into a pathology that imprisons women, you get Islam much more than a healthy sort. Is that what you're saying?
So I would say that the core axiom of Islam is different. We have three great monotheistic religions. We have Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And I'm going to do broad strokes here that will probably offend the hell out of a lot of people.
Great.
Christianity is fundamentally about faith and love. Islam is fundamentally about submission. And Judaism is fundamentally about creation and then using that creation to relate to God. And so you have three different approaches in the world, in the monotheistic world. All three are valid ways of approaching God. I'm not saying there's one exclusive method that people can use to relate to Hashem. But I think that the create and relate perspective is one that ends up getting people onto a very positive, productive building path that makes the world a better place because people are walking in the path of Hashem. And so while the Muslims can be about submission, it is our role to help them also be about creation, not just relating to God. And in the Christian world, much of the Christian world has become secular, especially in Europe. And it's our mission, perhaps, to help the Christian world relate to God where they're very creative and productive. And this gives meaning on one end, and it gives vitality and meat to meaning on the other end. And there can be Jewish elements of all these other faiths and all the other places in the world that belong and can enrich people's lives, even though they themselves don't have to be and shouldn't be Jewish.
Are we, in your opinion, supposed to be preaching and teaching to Christians and to Muslims, or are we supposed to be doing our very best on our own to work on ourselves as individuals, as communities, as nations, and to be a light unto the nations without necessarily trying to direct and to control other people's trajectories? You understand the question?
So direct and control, no. The idea of the city is that you bring people who want to be there, who want to find a new way, and you enable people of that culture to find a new way. One of the beautiful things, you mentioned at the beginning of your episode, that you're meeting different and interesting people without having to go very far in Israel. One of the beautiful things about Israel is that we have the shadow of almost every culture on earth here. People have come from India. I used to daven in an Indian synagogue here in Modi'in. People have come from Ethiopia, from Morocco, from America, from China. People come from everywhere, and Jews in all these different places keep Judaism, but they also carry with them cultural baggage from the places that they came from. And so what you end up with is a society uniquely in Israel that can also talk to every other society and culture on earth.
I mean, arguably, that's part of what the exile was for. The design of it, from a sort of a mystical Kabbalistic point of view, is that there were sparks of light that were disseminated all over the world. And when you send the Jewish people there, we're collecting these sparks of light and bringing them back to the land of Israel so we can elevate them, because there's light within every people and with every nation. Every human being is created in the image of God. So to be able to harness all that up, which is why the city you're talking about is very appealing to me, but I still hold that this city, which is a beautiful idea and really worth conveying in this book, because it is easier to convey in some ways than the, you know, I believe it's our job as Jews to love every human being in the world, but it's sort of hard to love every human being when so many of them are wanting to wipe you off the map and to kill you and so full of vitriol and hatred. But there's this little petri dish called the Nation of Israel, which it's a little bit easier in some ways to love every Jew, and then we can extrapolate that further on. So this city you're talking about helps us wrap our mind around the greater idea that I think Israel is.
So I definitely see parts of that here. But when you look at Israel's economy now, so much of it is about communicating with everybody else. We have technologies and we make them available to everybody else. We're able to talk to everybody else. We're really in this generation in Israel. It won't be the case once everybody is assimilated within the country. But in this generation in Israel, we're at a point where we have all of these cultures here, and we have a unique opportunity not just to gather the holiness of the world, but to actually take the holiness and raise ourselves up and also speak to the rest of the world. And so you laid out a dichotomy between preaching and living by example, and I think both have to happen. Not necessarily preaching in such a pedantic way, but by giving an opportunity for our lessons to show how those lessons could be applied in other places. So Great Britain had Hong Kong, showing how capitalism could be applied and help in China. West Berlin was an outpost to show how other ideas could be applied. I think this is something that applies to the Jewish world as well. Heck, we could establish a city with a local's approval in Africa and enable people to come and live under a different system, which would be African in nature, but would also be instilled with a sprinkling of this of these core Jewish concepts. And by virtue of doing that, we would be able to have a model in another part of the world where people will be able to look and say, you know what, these are people, sub-Saharan Africans, where it has a lot of problems. These are people who are sub-Saharan Africans, and they're building a society in this new way. And you know what? We'd like to borrow some of those ideas. And that can be something that's very powerful.
The city I think that is coming to mind was Uganda. That was already rejected. Jerusalem, to me, is the city that you're describing.
Yeah, but this
that
is not
what Jerusalem is.
This is not a place for Jews to live. This is a place for Jewish ideas to live and be able to help other cultures.
How is that not Jerusalem again?
Jerusalem is a polyglot of all different sorts of people, but the nature of a society that is...
But the custodians of this polyglot are the Jewish people.
That's right.
And the Jewish ideas are disseminating around the world. I mean, look at you and your six children. That's from Eisha Torah, centered in Jerusalem, right? Jerusalem is really a message that gets out there, which to me, when I picked the lot on my property in the hills of Judea, the one that I picked was not the one with the most fantastic view. It was the one where I could best see Jerusalem. Because the reason that I'm doing everything out there in Judea is for Jerusalem. Wherever you are, if it's for Hashem, it's for Jerusalem. So to me, that's really what you're describing here.
The book is called The City on the Heights. That's a reference to Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is the city on the hill.
So I haven't read this book yet, but I'm excited to. And I would suggest everybody else take a look at it. CityOnTheHeights.com. His name is Joseph Cox. Better know a Jew. This is a great Jew to know. And I'd suggest you come to Modi'in, because there are other Jews like this here in Modi'in that, and in the land of Israel, just walking through the streets, where if you just stop people, you say, wow, that is a mind. It's like a magnet for the most interesting people in the world. And Joseph Cox, it has been an honor to have you on the show. Yes.
Thank you very much for having the show. And I have to second that. I've had some fascinating conversations with people I've met randomly in the street. And it's a wonderful place to be. It's really, really exciting.
Joseph Cox, CityOnTheHeights.com. This is Ari Abramowitz from Modi'in, Israel. You can always reach out to me, Ari@thelandofisrael.com. If you have any emails or questions for Joseph, you can send them to me, or you can reach out to him directly if you want that. Sure. What is your...
Go through the website.
Through the website, cityonlights.com. You could reach out to him directly. Shalom, shalom.
All men dream, but not equally, says T.E. Lawrence. Those who dream by night in the dusty recesses of their minds wake in the day to find that it was vanity. But the dreamers of the day are dangerous men. They may act their dream with open eyes to make it possible. Now I'm trying to keep my eyes open and watch as my dream unfolds around me, because I'm Rav Mike Foyer, and this is The Jewish Story.
Join Rav Mike Foyer for the best Jewish history podcast, The Jewish Story, on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.